And also they won't, 10, 15 years ago we used to specify in the two parking spaces per dwelling, and now they're often have to accept new build without any parking provision at all.
Any car parking provision at all.
So that's interesting. That part, I know it's only a small part of the land, it's switched dramatically.
I was interested in that.
You had a thing. Going back onto the Finnish model, because I've just come back from Finland. One of the questions that they're raising now is the facilities when you arrive at work. Because what they're finding is you arrive at work, you've already got parking, you're all right with that. You then try and, you haven't got any showers or anything. And so the problem there is they're now having to look at changing facilities, showers, because depending on the type of work you do, depending on how acceptable it is to, you know, well, it doesn't take much to imagine. You can't walk into a suit meeting, you know, having just got the bicycle. So
I think in a way it goes back to this map. So because we work with data and quite big data sets, what we do is quite skewed by what data is available. It's very difficult to get data on showers and stuff out of it. So I think this is almost a question of, there's always a limit of how much modelling can do, and then you've got to pass it over to political will and common sense and good policies, essentially, at the local level. And I think as long as we frame our work as evidence that you can use as part of the solution rather than the overall solution, then we'll be okay. But I totally take your point. And there's a whole constellation of small interventions that can just make cyclists feel welcome. Showers is one of them. I mean, in the university, I think they have done things where they had free breakfast for cyclists. There's cycle training.
Not all the time, though. Just one day. Yeah. One day a year.
Yeah, one day a year or something. So, you know, there are many, many things that our model doesn't take account for. And I totally agree that showers on premises is a good thing. The question from a policy perspective is, how do you promote all of those things? And again, there's many more policy levers than people assume. So politicians can actually do a lot of things to promote cycling and incentivize companies. The interesting thing that's happened as well is that to some extent it's the private it's the kind of private companies who are pushing on this harder. I think I'm not an expert in this area, but there is strong evidence to suggest that if your workers are physically fit and healthy, if they've done a bit of exercise before work, they will have productivity. And I can imagine these bureaucrats looking at the data of, like, saying 30% more productivity. An amazing example is Jaguar Land Rover. Okay, I've heard that they have had a revolution in the amount of people cycling to the work. And I think it's ironic that their factory, where they're producing the vehicles that are making life hard for cycling, to get into work every day, cycling is really being promoted there. And apparently the reason for that was parking space. Space was at a premium. Jaguar Land Rover is obviously highly profitable at the moment. But that apparently is a kind of textbook example of cultural shift to cycling in an organisation you wouldn't have expected, and with no state intervention whatsoever.
But I think I've heard of things like workplace parking levies, where they kind of make it more expensive. You know, if a company's got to pay for the amount of car parking spaces it has, and therefore they say, well, we'll cut the car parking spaces and put some bike racks in.
Yeah.
Oh, there's one there, right there, okay.
Shifting over to electric cars from 2020 onwards. Just out of interest. Now, what I was going to say was, in near where I live, I think we're still in West Yorkshire, it just shades up into North Yorkshire a bit, but they relocated a section of the A1 because there was a very high incidence of lorries overturning and accidents. So they straightened it out, and basically they used the previous motorway, cut it into two and made traffic going both ways in one half of what was the motorway, and then they made a bank all the way up to Walshford, and then they made a cycle track down between Walshford and Weatherby.
Okay.
And the funny thing is, because I drive up and down there ever such a lot, and all the cyclists seem to go on the main road and they don't go down the cycle track, which is marked. So I thought it'd be interesting to ask somebody at the university to find out why this specially designed cycle track is being used by the cyclists.
So
if you're going to start making cycle tracks, you want to make sure
So, just to, I'm always about the evidence and looking at the detail to answer the question. So, can we just locate this road on the map? This is Weatherby.
Yes.
Is it north of Weatherby?
It's just going to Walshford, yes, parallel to the A1. It's what used to be the
overall. So, I don't actually know the local area too well. Is it one of these roads coming out? Let's see. Yeah. Anyway, so the question there was, why is it in some cases where you have a bad cycle path, where you have a cycle path, do people not use it? And
It's this one here. That's the new A1.
Okay, and this is the parallel.
Yeah, you can see there's a green bank, and then on this side there's a cycle track going quite a long way, and yet for some reason very few of the cyclists seem
to use it.
So
you drive along here and you can see cyclists on the
track. Oh, I drive on the road
So you can see very few people on there.
Well, you can't really see because there's a bank, but I see loads of cyclists on the actual road.
Yeah.
Rather than on the on the cycle track.
It's an interesting question. To me, it would, if I were designing cycle infrastructure, it would start raising questions. And again, from the evidence perspective, you can start looking at surface roughness. Is it high quality in terms of stopping and starting? If you were to look at the Strava tracks that people are going along here, you could look at average speeds. So one problem with the Leeds Bradford Cycle Superhighway is that if you really want to get from Leeds to Bradford and you're doing it as a commute, you don't want to be stopping at lights all the time, and you don't want to be having displaced your level all the time. So I would say that potentially it's not conducive for long distance. I don't know the context, but I think this local knowledge is really important, and you can't just say, oh, if you've got a cycle path, it's okay. It has to be high quality cycling infrastructure. So I don't know the answer in this particular case. I think it would be really interesting, and it certainly would make a good study. I'll bear that in mind. I'd also look to see if we could get any crowdsourced data, which is something I haven't talked about. Can we get some kind of GPS data of these cyclists, or go out and ask them? That's the ultimate solution to these things. But it's very different. Everything we do needs to scale nationally. So you cannot use that solution for the national problem. But for this case, the local planner or the local cycle campaign group should go and ask people.
I was wondering about Leeds City Council. You say you'd like to work with them, but you're not working with them yet.
Yeah.
When do you think you might be? Because it seems to be really...
Well, is it in our court? Is it in their court? I don't know. We do have links with both Leeds City Council, and they actually wrote Simon Foy, who's head of evidence in the Leeds City Council, wrote a letter of support for this project. And to be honest, I think doing this event and seeing the interest here is a good stimulus for us to actually, it's in our court, get on it. Just communicate with them. I would love it if they came to me and Malcolm and said, oh, can you design our strategic cycle network? We would say yes, for sure. But at the moment, it hasn't happened. So I think just getting this dialogue's happening at a low level. The other factor to take into account is that Malcolm and I are working as hard as we can to build this stuff at the national level. So if we get too focused on our parochial little bubble of Leeds, we risk losing sight of it. However,
well, you could use it as a model.
Exactly. There's great potential benefits of, because I know Leeds relatively well, if you use it as a case study, the feedback that comes into it can improve it at the national level. And that's exactly what we did in the previous project. So I think that's a very good suggestion.
I'm sure they like it if you sort of, you know, Leeds is the focus of this great national project. I'd love all that. Also, well, at the back there, yeah.
Okay, yeah. So I've got a follow-up point from that. You're absolutely right. There's a difference in how... So in the UK, cycle paths are a bit new. They're a bit different, especially in somewhere like Yorkshire. So people are... The kind of financing models and the kind of maintenance are just... We're having teething problems with that. And it is very much a capital focus with a lack of revenue. I think that is an issue. I think there are ways to generate revenue that benefit cyclists, like going back to the point of having a small levy on car parking spaces. There are many other ways that you can generate generate revenue. The one thing that's quite creative in terms of how to refinance these, a lot of public transport schemes apparently are part financed by capital. And then the companies that get the projects get paid in proportion to ridership. So if loads of people use your new guided busway, for example, you get more money for your scheme. And there are real proposals in Sao Paulo in Brazil to build a huge citywide multi-million pound cycle network using this financing scheme that says if you build this network, we'll pay you the bare minimum, and then the profit that you get depends on people using it. And I bet you anything that if this cycle lane in Wetherby was that they got their return based on number of people using it, the contractors and the people project managing it would be damn sure that it was very high quality. So that's a very good point, and a problem that's affecting cycling infrastructure. So yeah.
Stephen Craven, Leeds Cycling Campaign. You've made some good points, and I'm really glad you're doing this. And I think we did see this tool demonstrated at a Space for Cycling workshop last year as well. My question is, in your modelling, are you taking into account any future population growth, and in particular specific areas such as East Leeds, where there's going to be a huge amount of new housing coming up?
Again, this is a very good question, and it's actually a question that comes up a lot, particularly from the local authorities. So this is something that people actually doing the planning ask us a lot. They say, okay, you've given us a good model for 2011, which you tell us is a good proxy for current behaviour. I think it is, but it's not necessarily the most realistic basis for future demand. And if I go back to the route network, let's see if that's this, just while this loads. The answer to that is we're not taking it into account. The fact that this exists has taken a huge amount of research, and we've been working as hard as we can. But you can see each dot here represents around 7,000 people or around 3,000 commuters. I believe there's going to be more development happening. Let's say that there's going to be loads more housing here. It's perfectly possible to get data and simulate where these are going to go and include that in the model. That is possible using exactly the same methods. If Leeds City Council gives us the data, which I've been told that they have, we can do this. Or even they could do it. We could say, these are all the methods, go ahead and do it. But unfortunately, and this is something that we've talked to the Department for Transport about, there is no open data set about what the travel pattern will be nationwide in 2025 that is open access. They've actually promised us last week on Thursday that they would give us a data set on future projections. That's something that Malcolm and I will have to take into account. But you can understand the fact that we're doing this nationally kind of constrains us to looking at data sets that are available nationally. But yes, they can do it and the methodology can work, but we just haven't done it due to lack of time and priorities. But a very good point, so thanks for that.
Yeah. I live in Chapel Allerton, and if I were to work in town, then it's virtually mostly downhill into town. So if I was working and I was commuting to work, then it would mean in the morning when I'm nice and fresh, and at the end of the day, it's a lot harder going uphill. So obviously, electric bikes is the answer.
Yeah.
So
okay.
Is there any, or is there any, ever any talk about subsidising e-bikes to make them more available and accessible?
I think it has been talked about. The government is providing lavish funding for electric cars, and it has been pointed out by Cycling UK and others that it's not fair that you're promoting one kind of electric vehicle and not another. So there's definitely a lot of talk about this. For whatever reason, the lion's share of the funding goes to electric cars. I think you'd have huge, much greater benefits for promoting electric bikes than electric cars, given that it can reduce car dependency. It's much more affordable, even for a £2,000 bike, is much more affordable than a £20,000 electric car, which is what Tesla, Elon Musk will sell you. So there is talk about it, but there's not the money at the moment in terms of subsidising it as a form of transport. What you can do though is get a subsidy via the Travel to Work scheme if you're working, but if you're not, then I don't know is the answer, but I wish there was, and it's a very, very good point.
Well, it is, I think, you know, the places where there's lots of bikes is when it's flat. So York, Cambridge, and so on. So actually, I think electric bikes are the ones that then make it equal between these places that are a level.
Just an anecdote. So the question was about, and this is, I mean, I have the worst of both worlds because I live in Chapel Town and I've got to go down Meadow Valley and then up the other side. So I always have a big uphill. Whether it's to work or to home, or it seems like it, and it does seem like a bigger uphill on my way home. But I think even worse for me was when I lived at the bottom of a big hill in Bristol, where I went to university. I had to cycle uphill to get to work or university, and then come down all fresh. I much prefer it the other way around, because at least if you get home and you're all smelly and tired, you can relax and sit down and have a shower. If you get to work and you're tired, then that's not good. So I think you have it. I think you have it the good way around, relatively speaking. But I agree on the electric bike points. It's true.
Just wanted to make a kind of cynical comment about Leeds City Council, I suppose, what you get them involved. I noticed that before the Tour de Yorkshire took place, there were hardly any cycle lanes in Leeds City Centre at all. Then almost overnight, these cycle lanes appeared before the television event.
I mean, money talks. I mean, I think that you can use the economic arguments when you start talking about £23 million per year of health economic savings. If you start talking about increased revenue in restaurants, you start talking about tourism. Then you can win the economic argument as well. I, in some ways, I don't see that as a problem. And the Tour de Yorkshire was very much an economic focus. An ex-student of mine tried to quantify the economic benefits of the Tour de Yorkshire, and that was really what was driving it. It wasn't so much the health. That was like a co-benefit. So I would love to see more research into the cycle tourism, the benefits of reduced car travel in the city centre. And has anyone seen, there's a couple of places where every Friday and Saturday night they just cut off the street to cars. There's one near the A60, is it North Street, where they do this? But yeah, I think you're dead right, it is driven by the economics, but actually we can win the economic argument as well.
I just want to echo Dave's cynicism with some scepticism of my own about the City Council.
Yeah.
I remember about 12 years ago when the council renovated the Burley Road, which I used to cycle along to work.
Yeah.
And I had an exchange of emails with the transport department saying, are you going to put in a segregated cycle lane while you're resurfacing it? And they said, no, it's too narrow, we haven't got enough space. Despite the fact there were cars parked along most of it, and if you remove the parked cars, there would be enough space for good segregated cycle lanes on both sides. And then a few years after that, they renovated the Kirksall Lane and made this bus corridor, and I had the same conversation with them again. Are you going to put in segregated cycle lanes? No, we're going to expect the cyclists to cycle in the bus lane, so sharing space with 6 tons of bus. And they couldn't really legitimately say that the Kirksall Lane is too narrow, because it's about 100 metres across now. They just don't want to do this. They're not interested in doing any of this work. I think the propensity to cycle at all is great, but actually it's blindingly obvious that the A660 is the one to do, because there are 20 or 30,000 students living in Headingley.
Yeah.
And you don't really need the PCT tool to tell you that this is the best place to do it. The City Council will not go up against the driving lobby. It's as simple as that.
So, well, they drive themselves.
So this is rapidly becoming political, and that's good. I mean, science is a bit political. There's an organisation called Scientists for Global
Responsibility.
And as a researcher, you've always got to kind of tread a bit of a balance between stepping into the political fray and saying we're providing objective evidence. You can tell that I am of the opinion that cycling is part of the sustainable transport mix. But just all I can say is a couple of comments there. Regarding the PCT, you may not need evidence to know that this is a good thing, but it can certainly help.
Oh, sure.
And there's been Just one example, anecdotal example. There's a sustainable transport officer in Liverpool who was saying, I know where's good, but I keep getting outgunned by the modelling coming from the car from the car guys, and they're blinding people with science and saying, we've got all the numbers of our car models, and if you have a counter model that's showing actually we're modelling cycling on a big scale, we can show the benefit cost ratios, we can talk about capacity, that can really help strengthen your argument. So hopefully, you know, we would hope that your local knowledge is reinforced and strengthened by the evidence. And your other point was about the transport department in Leeds City Council. I do think to some extent it's generational. So there's a new generation of transport engineers who are learning different techniques. The Institution for Civil Engineers has got guidance on cycling, Highways England. So there's very much a kind of generational paradigm shift. If you go to TfL, Transport for London, there's a different group of people. So I think we are in the middle of a gradual generational shift, and hopefully that's happening in Leeds. And I think different local authorities are happening at different rates. And I've looked at Transport for Greater Manchester as a transport planning authority outside of Leeds that seems relatively progressive. So I just think it's going to take time, and I think it is getting better generationally. So they're my comments on
perhaps
that.
Perhaps on that optimistic note, we should call it to a close, especially I think you probably had a longer spot, and it's been very good. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
We probably could have another pint, maybe up in the bar.
Maybe a half.
Maybe a half up in the bar.